Welcome to Parenting Matters on Nashville Catholic Radio, WBOU 100.5 FM, sponsored by the Family Life Office of the Diocese of Nashville. Your host for the program is Dr. Parr Donahue. Dr. Parr has years of experience in pediatrics and parenting. He was named the Senior Pediatrician of the Year by the Tennessee Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2014. Dr. Parr is the author of four books, including books on parenting entitled Messengers in Denim, The Amazing Things Parents Can Learn from Teens, and Tools for Effective Parenting. Visit Dr. Parr's blog at www.parentingwithdrparr.com. Here's your host, Dr. Parr Donahue.
Welcome to Parenting Matters on WBOU FM, 100.5 on your dial, and streaming throughout the world on WBOU.org. Our topic today, your child and immunizations. Our guest expert is Dr. Michelle Fiskus, Medical Director of the Tennessee Immunization Program at the Tennessee Department of Health. A great big welcome to you, Shelley, and to you, our listeners. I will introduce you soon, but first my monologue. Some years ago, a then well-respected doctor in England faked a study, data and all, and published it in one of the world's most prestigious medical journals. This so-called study showed that the measles vaccine caused autism. This false data were compelling. Since then, the CDC and other institutions found no connection between measles vaccine, MMR, or any other immunizations and autism, and called the work into question. All pediatricians and other physicians welcomed the condemnation and tried to convince reluctant parents to continue using the measles vaccine. Finally, the English doctor admitted he had fabricated the entire study by making up phony data. He said he had been paid to do so by a pharmaceutical company. He admitted guilt, lost his license to practice in the United Kingdom. Due to this historic lie, many kids are now getting measles and mumps. Yet, since then, millions of children have been studied over more than 20 years, and it has been determined beyond a shadow of a doubt that vaccines do not cause autism. In the long run, his malfeasance has been very costly to kids in the United States and in the rest of the world. In the 50s, more than 300,000 kids in the United States contracted measles every year. After the vaccine was developed, the number fell rapidly to an all-time low of 55 in 2012, but it has been increasing since this publication of its horrible fraud. As of July this year, the United States had more than 1,100 cases in 30 different states, the greatest number of cases in nearly 30 years. Worldwide today, measles is responsible for approximately 91,000 deaths annually. Measles is not a benign disease. Thank God for the people who developed the vaccine. Now I have the privilege of welcoming Dr. Fiskus back to Parenting Matters on WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming throughout the world on WBOU.org. Shelley was the first guest on our very first show last fall. Dr. Fiskus is an outstanding pediatrician, mother of two, and an outstanding citizen. She practiced pediatrics in Franklin before joining the Tennessee Department of Health, where she is the medical director of the state's immunization program. Welcome back to our show, Shelley.
Thanks, Parr. It's really good to be back with you.
It's always good to see you. Let me start with a couple of broad questions. What are immunizations? Really, what are they, and how are they made, and are they really dangerous, or are they safe?
You're going to start with a simple one.
Yeah, simple.
Okay.
That's what I said.
So immunizations or vaccines are a type of medicine that we can give someone that contains just a little bit of what a virus or a bacteria or some other thing that might make you sick uses, you know, has as part of their makeup. So, for example, we might have a flu virus, and there might be a little particle from that flu virus that gets put into a vaccine, and then that's given as a shot, usually, to someone. And the immune system then sees that little particle and makes an antibody or soldiers against that particular thing. And it creates the antibodies, and then everything kind of calms back down. But the body has this amazing ability to remember things. And so when the body actually sees the flu virus, those little antibodies wake back up and say, oh, I've seen this little tiny thing that's on the side of this flu before. I should go kill that. And so instead of it taking a long time for the body to react to that flu virus, it can react very, very quickly and wipe that virus out before it has a chance to make someone sick. And so there are lots of vaccines that have been developed, and we've had vaccines for more than 200 years that have done an amazing job of getting rid of a lot of death and suffering across, you know, not just the United States, but all over the world.
Shelley, you use the word antibodies. What's the difference between an antibody and an antibiotic? Why don't I just give you some penicillin if you get measles?
Yeah, that would be a bad thing to do that. So an antibody is something that the body naturally makes for its own defense. So it's the soldiers that happen. So you get sick with a virus or a bacteria, and your body automatically makes these little soldiers to go and kill it. Sometimes there are bacteria that the body has a really hard time fighting. And so antibiotics are medications that can be given that actually destroy parts of the bacteria. They only work on bacteria. So things like the flu and measles and mumps and polio are not bacteria. So antibiotics don't help. But those antibiotics can sometimes be used to destroy the cell walls or destroy how bacteria make copies of themselves and can help people get better faster in some situations. The good thing about vaccines is vaccines prevent disease. So antibiotics treat disease that's already there and making you sick, and immunizations actually prevent you from ever getting sick to begin with.
The body is phenomenal, isn't it?
It's an amazing thing.
You know, stomach aches, and I'm sure yours does too, every time I think about all the kids who are not getting vaccines and are suffering or even dying from diseases, which are preventable. They're preventable, and yet some people don't use the vaccines. So what about the use of mercury in vaccines?
Oh, so that's one of the myths that's kind of propagated out there. So people hear the word mercury and they think about mad hatters and the stuff that's inside thermometers that make people sick sometimes. Mercury in that form is a toxin to the neurological system. But there are lots of things that are made of other things that are put together. For example, hydrogen can explode. That's what the Hindenburg blew up from, was hydrogen gas. But you put hydrogen with oxygen and that makes water together, which is life-saving for all of us and required for life. Mercury can be the same way. You can put mercury with other things and it can be something that's beneficial as opposed to mercury that you find in a thermometer, which is not. So there was in vaccines a preservative that was used to prevent vaccines from becoming contaminated with bacteria called thimerosal. You may have heard that if you use contact lenses. It might be in your contact lens solution. It's in lots of things. And thimerosal is related to mercury, but it is not mercury itself. So there were concerns from people who were worried that maybe thimerosal was causing some problems for children receiving vaccines. There were lots of studies to show that that was not the case. But in 2001, they were able to make vaccines that were just in single doses that were sealed and no longer required preservative. So they were able to eliminate thimerosal from the vaccines. And why wouldn't we eliminate something that doesn't need to be there anymore? So thimerosal was eliminated. Interestingly, things like autism and other illnesses that are blamed on vaccines or thimerosal did not become less common with the removal of thimerosal. But now the only vaccine that's used in the United States that has thimerosal as a preservative still is the multi-dose flu vaccine. So some people get flu that's drawn up out of a vial that has 10 doses in it, and that one has thimerosal as a preservative. Most people get a flu vaccine that's just one dose in a vial, and that one does not.
Thank you. We're going to start talking about individual vaccines, okay?
Sure.
When I started practice way back in the dark ages, many of today's vaccines had not been developed. I can't tell you how many spinal taps I did on kids who were sick and had fever and they looked ill, because if they have meningitis without treatment, they die. Then what a great relief it has been when they developed the immunization for H influenza meningitis. Now, that's not the virus influenza, but it's a bacterium. In the late 60s and the early 70s, I always had a kid in the hospital with meningitis. And I lived in this, worked in this little town in Wisconsin. Now, most pediatricians have never seen a case of Haemophilus influenza meningitis. Tell us about the disease and its vaccine.
Yeah, this is really one of the amazing success stories of vaccines. So, and I hear people from your generation and even the generation between ours who talk about the scourge of Haemophilus influenza in children caused a terrible respiratory infection called epiglottitis, which was terrifying, caused terrible meningitis that were literally when you did a spinal tap. Pus would come out of the backs of these children. It was horrible. And to me, that is something of legend and lore because even though I've been in pediatrics for more than 20 years, I have never once seen a case of Haemophilus influenza, meningitis, or in any other form. And that's because that vaccine came out in the mid-1980s. And within just a few years, basically wiped invasive H flu off of the map. And so we actually, as residents in training, had a hard time getting enough experience doing spinal taps because we just didn't do them all that often. I might have done a few dozen spinal taps in my 3 years of residency in pediatrics, whereas you were probably doing, a few dozen a month.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. I tell you, my oldest son, who is also a physician, is at one of the big medical institutions in the country. And he says the biggest medical advance in the 20th century was the flu vaccine.
Yeah, I believe that.
And he says changed all of medicine.
Right.
Well, there was in my chief in pediatrics when I was a resident, Dr. J.C. Peterson, was famous for his helping to develop the DPT and putting the three special things together. Now the DPT is called DTAP, some of that, and why is the name changing? What's different about it?
Yeah, it's always confusing when we change names up on things.
Yes, it is.
And so you'll hear DTP, DTAP, TD, DT, all of them kind of deal with the same thing. So the D is for diphtheria, which is a respiratory illness. It's a bacteria. It causes this terrible film over the back of the throat. You've probably seen diphtheria.
I have not seen
You've
one.
Never
no.
seen diphtheria. Mm-hmm. I have also never seen diphtheria. And it's very rarely reported now, although is starting to make a comeback. I heard about a case of invasive diphtheria in Canada not too long ago. And then the P is for pertussis, which is better known as whooping cough. I've seen whooping cough. I know you've seen whooping cough.
I've had whooping cough.
You've
twice.
Had
I had
whooping
it
cough.
When I was a kid, and I got it again about 3 years ago. We'll talk about that
and
later.
It's horrible.
Yes, awful.
And so whooping cough is also a bacteria that can often kill infants who are too young to be immunized. And then T is for tetanus. And one of the big misunderstandings about tetanus is not transmitted from person to person. Tetanus is a spore that is found in the earth. And so if you are a gardener or you are outside playing in the dirt, you can encounter tetanus. And if you are not immunized against tetanus, then that infection can cause something that's commonly known as lockjaw. And death from tetanus is almost 100% fatal and an absolutely excruciating way to die. So the DTP vaccine is one that we've used for many, many years. The pertussis component of that used to be what's called whole cell. So they basically took the whole bacteria for pertussis and they killed it, and then they put it in the vaccine. And it caused a lot of fevers in kids. And, I would rather have a fever than have whooping cough. They call whooping cough the year-long cough or something like that for good reasons, because you cough forever. But it caused a lot of fevers, and sometimes those fevers were high enough in young children that it would cause seizures. Not the kind of seizures that result in epilepsy, but a one-time seizure, and nevertheless terrifying for a parent to see. So they developed what's called an acellular pertussis vaccine, where now it's just part of that pertussis bacteria. As a result, we don't see as many fevers and we don't see as many seizures, But the trade-off is that the vaccine doesn't work quite as well as the whole cell pertussis vaccine. And so I think, you know, it's possible that we may start to see some movement back towards using something like a whole cell pertussis vaccine in the not too distant future.
Have you ever seen a case of lockjaw tetanus?
I have never seen a case. I've seen pictures of people who are basically in a back bend because their tetany or their muscle lock is so strong that only their head and their feet are on the table and the rest of them is contracted up. But I've never actually seen a case.
Well, I haven't either. One of my classmates in medical school went to practice in Iowa in a farming community, and he had a case of tetanus. And he, of course, without all of us know, he saw tetanus.
Yeah.
There was
a
so rare
child very recently who got tetanus, who was not vaccinated, and spent weeks and weeks and weeks in the hospital and rehab. The child actually did live. The hospital bill was about $900,000 to save that child. And when they left, the parents still refused to vaccinate that child. So there's no lifelong immunity to tetanus. That child is just as much at risk as he or she was before she contracted it the first time.
I remember when I was in grade school, one of my cousins, a little baby, died of diarrhea. Mm. I tell you, every time after I had a loose stool, I was in my deathbed, you know, I was so nervous. But I suspect that kid had rotavirus. But we didn't even hear about rotavirus till long after I was out of medical school. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there is nothing quite like rotavirus. And if there are nurses listening who've been in pediatrics, they will tell you there is nothing that smells like rotavirus. It causes just profuse watery diarrhea on the order of 10, 20 stools a day. And these kids can die from dehydration. They have very high hospitalization rate. It's very difficult to get kids to drink something to stay hydrated when their stomach's upset and they don't feel well. And, you know, thankfully we've had a vaccine for rotavirus that has done away with a lot of the cases of rota that we've seen, a lot of unnecessary suffering and hospitalization and a lot of preventable deaths.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like cholera, isn't it?
It's a little bit like that.
And not quite as contagious.
Right, yeah.
When do kids get those vaccines?
The rotavirus vaccine, they get it 2, 4, and 6 months typically. And it has to be given within the first 9 months of age because it's really designed to protect that child in the first 1 to 2 years of life. Once you're out of that range, you're usually old enough where you can hydrate yourself and recover from an illness like rota. Although I know adults who've had rota who would say, you know, they would take a vaccine in a heartbeat because it's absolutely miserable.
Mm-hmm. You know, you probably never saw a case of, an iron lung either, did you?
I've never seen someone in iron lung, although I had a conversation with a 85-year-old woman just the other day who is a polio survivor who spent a summer in an iron lung, who called me for some resources on because she was getting ready to have surgery, and the anesthesiologists were concerned about, you know, what kind of problems she might have.
Well, my aunt was one of my, you know, I have a lot of aunts and uncles, but my favorite aunt got polio in the 50s sometime, right? Mm. I guess it was in the 40s. But I was a little boy at that time, and it was such much panic in the country about polio that we weren't allowed to go to church during the summertime because we didn't want to be around any other kids because we had to just sit on a little farm. And my aunt got polio. Mm. And she spent the summer in an iron lung, and I got a chance to see her. It's unbelievable that somebody could have invented that machine. But now we have the vaccines for it.
Right.
Tell us about them.
Right. So back in the 50s, a man named Dr. Jonas Salk invented a vaccine to prevent polio, and it, again, was a killed version of the polio virus. Polio is caused by a virus. We can't treat it with antibiotics. If you get it, you have to just deal with what hand you're given. And people, once they realized that this vaccine was available, lined up four blocks around buildings to come get that vaccine. It was really impactful in ending the polio epidemic as they knew it then in the United States and around the world. And a few years after that, an oral version of that vaccine was developed. And the reason for that was because it was a little more stable to ship places. They could get it into areas of countries where maybe refrigeration wasn't available, so it was a little more stable. It was a little cheaper. They could give it to more people, and it's, you know, sometimes easier to give someone drops on their tongue than it is to give them a shot in the arm. And that vaccine actually did pretty well too, until we got to a point where there were so few cases of polio in the United States and around the world that the only cases that we were seeing were ones that were coming from that live virus vaccine. And so it's a very long and kind of convoluted story as to why that vaccine has caused a few problems with polio. But it's the vaccine that is being used still in third world countries to control polio. And for every few thousand kids that get vaccinated with that vaccine, there may be one that actually develops polio because that's a live virus vaccine in those drops. You and I both received that version of the vaccine. So, I mean, the vast majority of people, it was safe and it prevented polio. But when the numbers are so small now for actual wild-type polio, we can sometimes see that vaccine cause it. So several years ago in the United States and in the developed world, we switched back to the injected polio vaccine that has the killed virus in it that is absolutely incapable of making people sick.
I had the injection when I was a little kid. I don't remember that, but then when the oil came out, we were lined up, like you said, around the block. Yeah. We waited 2 hours in the hot sun to get that. And I think you had to go three times because you could get type strain one, two first, then strain three, and then strain one or something like that. But we got it, and then, of course, I've had an injection since then.
Yeah, and when I was working in Africa a few years ago, when the villagers would find out that we were coming to give vaccines of any kind, people would walk for 10, 20 miles with their children strapped on their backs to come and get oral polio vaccine and the injected vaccines that we had to offer them because they've seen these illnesses still, you know, and this was 10 years ago when I was in Africa, they were still seeing these illnesses.
And, you know, Shelley, when I was in practice in Wisconsin, I had this boy come into the hospital and he had asthma, really bad attack of asthma, or at least I thought it was asthma, treated him for it, he got better, but when he went, it's discharged him at morning. And about noon, a call from the nurse says, well, Mrs. Jones is here to take her baby home, but he can't stand up. So let me walk over and see him. So I walked over there, and he wouldn't stand up. Now, I thought maybe he just wanted to go home so badly. It says, well, you just take her home and see what happens. Well, she called me the next day. He hasn't stood up yet. I said, holy crap, something's wrong here. So we had drawn viral studies at the hospital, and then we took him back and we drew studies for the polio virus, and they sent them into the state lab, and this was Wisconsin, not Tennessee. And so we, 3 weeks, we drew another one and sent that in, but the first one never arrived, and we don't know whether he had polio or not. So I've been reading in the past couple of years about a virus. Another virus can cause asthma, respiratory virus, and then it can get post-polio. Now, I don't know what happened to that boy, if he still can't walk or if he can get his walking back. I don't know because I've been away from there for 30 years. So.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we've seen this emerging illness that's now called acute flaccid myelitis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we've had three cases in Tennessee in 2018 of AFM.
Mm-hmm.
There's been about 500 cases around the country since 2014 when they started tracking this. And it does appear to be caused by a virus, and it causes sudden limb weakness in one, two, three, or four extremities, and then pretty rapidly tends to progress to trouble swallowing, trouble breathing. And some different viruses have been implicated in that. One of them is an enterovirus, and unfortunately, enteroviruses are all over the place. Like we all get enteroviruses, but for some reason, this one particular enterovirus in a certain kind of kid, and we don't understand who that is yet, can sometimes develop this almost polio-like syndrome. We know that it's not polio, but it can cause this weakness. And difficulty breathing, and some of those kids have been on ventilators and had a hard time recovering from that. So still really rare. One in about a million children a year are being affected by AFM, but it is something new that we're looking at.
Could you tell us about the hepatitis B and A viruses and the vaccines? Because this is another thing that came out since I got out of medical school.
Sure. Yeah. So hepatitis B, let's start with that one. So hepatitis B is a virus that's caused by, or that causes liver inflammation, and it causes chronic liver disease in people, and it can lead to liver cancer. And so when a mom who's infected with hepatitis B has a baby, there's a very high chance that that baby is going to become infected. And if the baby becomes infected, there's about a 40% chance that that baby's going to die young because of chronic liver disease. So we started vaccinating those babies at birth, really, against hepatitis B. And the good news is that we don't see as much of that now. But we're also hoping to have a population of people who are no longer impacted by hepatitis B because they were vaccinated as children, and that's an opportunity to wipe that virus out. The other is hepatitis A, which causes a quick infection of the liver. And it's usually not that big of a deal, but right now we have epidemics all over the United States of hepatitis A. In Tennessee, we typically have about five to 10 cases a year. Over the last 14 months, we've had 2,200 cases in Tennessee. It's had a huge impact on our hospitals. 6 out of 10 people who've had the disease have been hospitalized. We've had at least 13 people who have died. And we're seeing that illness mostly in people who are using recreational drugs or who are homeless because it's transmitted through stool. And so if they don't have access to places to wash their hands, then they can transmit that virus. Fortunately, we've been immunizing children for about 13 years or so across the United States. So the children are by and large protected from this outbreak that's going on right now. But we have all of these adults that are falling ill. And that is also an illness that is preventable with vaccination.
Shelley, we're really running out of time, but I do want to talk about the cancer vaccine.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us about that.
So the human papillomavirus vaccine is unfortunately met with some undue controversy, but that is the second anti-cancer vaccine that we have that we can give children, the first being the hepatitis B vaccine.
Yes.
Causes liver cancer. This one, human papillomavirus, causes cervical cancer, penile cancers, anal cancers, head and neck cancers, all kinds of bad cancers, and tens of thousands of people develop those cancers every year, and tens of thousands of people die from them. And so we have a highly effective and extremely safe vaccine that has been developed that we can give children before they have the opportunity to become infected with that virus, just like we do for children to protect them from polio or measles or mumps or any other virus that we want to try to protect them from. And so if those children are vaccinated with that vaccine, it is wiping out almost 100% of some types of those cancers, which is amazing. I'm a breast cancer survivor myself. Mm-hmm. If we had a breast cancer vaccine, I would be given it in each arm of each of my children to prevent that. We have a virus or a vaccine that can prevent cancer that is from a virus that 80% of us have been infected with, and that 20% of those people will end up developing HPV-related cancers.
Thank you, Shelley, so very much. It was very, very interesting, very exciting. You are listening to Parenting Matters on WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming throughout the world at WBOU.org.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Parenting Matters with Dr. Parr Donahue. Parenting Matters is produced and recorded inside the studios at the Catholic Pastoral Center. Thanks again for listening to WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming at WBOU.org.